Hey everyone, welcome to Manufacturing Hub. It is Wednesday afternoon at about 4 o'clock East Coast time if you guys are joining us live. If it is your first time here, welcome. If you've been here before, welcome back. If it's your first time, Manufacturing Hub is an educational show. Every month we pick a topic. This month we're talking all about systems integration, and we have four fun conversations around that. And so if you guys want to get involved, we absolutely suggest go ahead and get involved. Our number one chat is on LinkedIn. I actually see Vlad on LinkedIn, which means that LinkedIn is not down as it was exactly 7 days ago, which caused us to not go live at that very moment. Vlad says he is here in the comments. So welcome, Vlad. But no, if you guys are here, please go ahead and drop comments in here on LinkedIn. We'll do our very best to go ahead and highlight some of them. If we aren't able to get to them or they're super technical questions, we'll do our very best to come back to them at a later point. Be sure to go ahead and tag us in them if you guys have specific and or technical questions, including for our guest, Huck, who we will go ahead and introduce in a moment. Very excited to have this conversation this week. We're talking all about systems integration. One of the things is Huck has traveled an awful lot. I feel like most of us who have worked in integration and this industry have traveled an awful lot. And we're going to go ahead and dive a bit into that. I will say some of the projects and things that Huck has done, I'm actually jealous of. And he like regales me with these awesome stories over the years. And so I'm happy we can go finally have that conversation. Having said that, I'd like to officially welcome everyone to Manufacturing Hub. This is episode 157. And our guest today and my friend Huck Bales is here. Huck, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Hello, thanks for having me. I'm excited for our conversation today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us again, Huck. Before we dive into the conversation around systems integrators, could you give us a bit more information about your background? How did you get started in manufacturing, automation, and ultimately walk us through your career?
Sure. I try to keep this a secret, but I actually started doing systems integration in 1984. So yeah, 40 years this June. And my first job out of college, I studied electrical engineering, and I thought I was going to do work in VLSI computer design. But the job that I got out of college was for a system integrator back in the day. And I fell in love with the thing, and I've been doing it ever since. And so that's in a nutshell it. I've worked for system integrators, my first job, as I said, and then different ones over the years. I've also worked for large engineering firms. And currently, I have my own consulting practice that I started just a few months ago called Working Systems. And this is actually my second time of having my own business. I started Old Growth Systems back in 2010, maybe 2011, something like that. And so all that time, I've been on the SI side, the system integrator side, the services side of building automation and MES systems, a lot of work on the MES side.
If I can, Huck, maybe start you off with a very easy question. How do we define as an industry what a systems integration company is, or I guess versus like a consulting firm, engineering firm? Mm-hmm. Is it a very vague definition, or is there maybe some specifics that you have in mind?
Actually, it's one of the things that I hope we talk about it later, but I want to say that a related question that I have for the two of you. But to answer that specific question, for me, a system integrator is a company whose primary business is building controls, automation, operations management, MES solutions for customers. When I say engineering firm, I'm talking about, I worked for CH2M Hill, which is a large multidisciplinary engineering firm that does all sorts of things. They build bridges, and they build, the part that I was interested in was industrial facilities. They'll build a semiconductor factory for you. And there's lots of structural engineers and architects and mechanical engineers. And then a lot of times the customer says, can you also build an automated control system for that facility? And so that's what I did when I was working for the engineering firms. And then the last part of your question is consulting, which is what I call my current business. I'm not today delivering working systems, even though that's the name of my customer, of my business, but I'm consulting in that space. So I'm helping either other system integrators with front end design kind of work, or I'm working directly for manufacturing companies that needs either some internal help or perhaps they need help interfacing to an integrator. And so that's where I am in my business today. It's just me. And my goal is not to grow this company. My goal is to go out and do interesting work.
Gotcha. And I guess maybe to segue us into the first topic that we wanted to get started on, but also ask, I want to say, a broader question as a starting point, right? So I think that there's different benefits that you get by working, let's call it, at a systems integrator of maybe a different size, for a consulting firm, for an engineering firm, or even like an end user. What were maybe some of your key takeaways, again, having so much experience, maybe for someone starting off at a systems integrator that you wouldn't get necessarily at maybe like as much of an end user or any other type of structure?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the obvious answer from my perspective, at least, is that you get to see lots of different environments and solutions. As Dave said, I've done a lot of travel and that's normal in the business. I've been in chicken processing factories. I've been in aluminum smelters. I've been in lots of semiconductor factories and flat panel display factories. And so I get to see all these different things. And to me, that's the compelling part. I think it's a harder job and a harder life, but I think for me, it's a lot more interesting to go and learn about all these different things. And I think it helps. And I think this is why a lot of manufacturing companies don't try to do it all in-house, is that a systems integration firm has people who have a broad experience. They've been in lots of different environments and they've built different systems. So they're going to have a better perspective on how to solve a problem and what are the best tools for that problem, right? If I work in one manufacturing company for my whole career, then I'm going to know about that factory really. I'm going to be an expert in what that factory does and how it works, but I might not be exposed to all of the new technologies that are available. I might not be exposed to what's the best controller today out there. And I think that's the difference between those two career paths.
I will make the comment before I pass it on to Dave is, I think it's absolutely fascinating how from vertical to vertical, you can find such big differences in automation, right? So I come from a fairly large company, I want to say structure, and I've seen very, I want to say, consolidated control systems on a very specific manufacturer that I will not name. But then if you go into oil and gas, it's very distributed, very kind of SCADA focused, very like, how do we get data from one single and then merge all of that data. So it's very different even between verticals in industrial automation, which I find fascinating. And I think you make a good point where if you see those differences, you can, obviously you're not going to take the IP, but you're going to take that knowledge with you and be able to reapply some of those principles to other verticals.
Yeah, that's what it is for sure.
Absolutely. I would agree that there are certainly some differences, but what I find as I work with different groups across different continents and different verticals is at the end of the day, the things that we do are all generally the same. Sometimes we use different pieces of technology, and a lot of that technology has to deal with how much money we have and are willing to spend. And that almost completely aligns with the importance of uptime or the importance of technology or the importance of competitive advantage when it comes to those technologies, which is why we see most of these automotive plants have thousands or tens of thousands of robots in them and so many kind of small to medium sized organizations that still do so much by hand. Now, Huck, a couple of weeks back, we had a gentleman named Nate call on, and we were talking about quality and compliance. And we were talking about how in like beauty and cosmetics, it is still like very common for people to go start building out of their spare bedroom or out of their garage or things like that. And there's no quality control. I think Nate told us a story about how he was working with a medium to large sized group, and they were making soap, but their soap was literally full of bacteria because of some sort of chemical miscalculation or some sort of compound miscalculation. So I would agree that there are certainly differences. I think there's absolutely value in going and understanding different verticals, because it's going to allow you to go take different pieces of technologies and some of those best practices. But Huck, as we alluded to, and as I know at least some of the stories, you, especially you and the family, had the opportunity during your career to move around a bunch. And I think that's one of both the benefits and perhaps most interesting parts of integration and this sort of work, is you could, in theory, go move to a place for a year or two and go work on some projects. And we've talked about a couple in the comments, but would you be willing to go tell us some of those stories as to how you guys got to moving around the world a little bit, and some of those positives and maybe some of those negatives?
Yeah, for sure. So it all started, I grew up in the Midwest, Kansas City, Missouri. And that first job was in Kansas City. And this company, they built custom control systems. And they expanded to Australia because they were working in the grain industry. And the market in the U.S. wasn't very good, but it was great in Australia. So they started selling their gear and their solutions to Australian grain processing factories. And so 2 years out of college, I'm this Midwestern kid who, I've seen the East Coast. I don't think I'd ever even seen the West Coast of the U.S. I get sent to Australia.
Okay.
And actually had a layover in Singapore on my first trip out of the country. So here I am walking around in the streets of Singapore, in the city of Singapore. And all of a sudden, my world just expanded tremendously. Yeah. And so I went and did the thing in Australia. It ended up being a 3 month assignment, and it was just, it was great. I just getting to experience another culture and seeing how other people live and go about their days was really interesting to me. From that point on, I watched for those opportunities, and whenever there was one, I took it. And fast forward a couple of years, and I'm newly married, and I come home and I say to my new wife, Nancy, "Hey, how would you like to go live in Australia?" And she says, "Not yes, but hell yes." And so there was this big project that this SI had over there, and I was going to be their local expert on the technologies that they had built and were deploying. And so it was 2 years. We lived in Sydney for the first year during the design phase. It was an aluminium smelter that I mentioned earlier. And they spent the first year doing the design in Sydney, and then we moved up the coast an hour and a half or so to a town called Newcastle, mm-hmm. and where we started up this, it was actually an expansion to an existing facility, but we started up this brand new part of this facility with all this new controls and operations management stuff. We were doing MES kind of stuff back in that day. And so it was great, both professionally and personally. Mm-hmm. Like I said, my wife and I were newly married, so it really brought us together. We had each other, and we were the only two people we knew in that country when we arrived. And it was really good. It was just a really good life experience. And one of the things that we're probably touch on a bit as this progresses, but I learned a thing from the Australians that I have tried to keep in my mind in more or less over the years, but they have a very different idea about work as a culture. They work so that they can live. Mm-hmm. They don't live to work. In the U.S., it's the norm for working 10 or 12 hours a day and working up the ladder and all the things. In Australia, 5 o'clock, they're gone. They just have a healthier, in my opinion, a healthier way mm-hmm. of thinking about what they do. They're working so they can get money so they can go out and live, and versus the opposite thing. So that was cool. And so we did that. And then when we came back from Australia, we decided not to go back to Kansas City. We ended up in Portland, where I've been ever since. And that's when I got involved in the semiconductor industry, which with an Intel project, we spent the year in Ireland. My firstborn was 6 months old when we went there. And when we came back, my second kid was 6 months in the hopper. He was conceived in Ireland. And which he's always still embarrassed about when I tell that story. But that's one of the other things that comes out here, is like the family dynamic, there's pluses and minuses to that as well, right? So those were the first two living abroad. The third and final story where I took the family was France, still in the semiconductor industry, a few years later, I think my kids, when we went there, were 4 and 6. And we spent 2 years in France, and none of us had any French at the time. I walked away still not having any. Nancy was able to, she wasn't working at the time. She was taking care of the kids, took the advantage of that opportunity to be with the kids for 2 years, which was great for them. And the kids were and still are, they came away totally fluent in French because they were still in that language acquisition phase of their lives. And my youngest especially, he's still completely fluent. And maybe completely random, but maybe not, he's actually today arrived, he just arrived in France. He's working on his PhD in physics, and has a fellowship he's studying for 4 months in the same town that we lived in France, believe it or not. Wow. So anyway, so that's my story of living in other places because of the work and because I sought it out and was engaged in. And every time we went to a new place, learning new things and about people and how they live their lives. And to me, that's really fascinating. And I think for me, at least, has given me a better perspective on how I want to live my life and how also how I interact with others in the world.
I ask you, Huck, if I may, I guess like for some advice who might be early in their career and is looking for those opportunities, because I think something has to be said about the right place in the right time. But ultimately, you've also mentioned you were looking for those opportunities and trying to see if anything could be influenced. Is there some advice maybe or something an engineer or I want to say like a resource of that nature can do to find those better?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you're right. It does. I think you have to be working for a company that's doing work internationally. So it could mean that I have friends who are working for multinational companies in the manufacturing space who are employees and deploying systems internally who have that same opportunity, get to go to other places where there are manufacturing, company has manufacturing all over the world. Lots of them do today. So I think that's one way is to, I think if that was something that you wanted to do, I would look for either a manufacturer who is multinational or an integrator or an engineering firm that's doing the same, that has customers that are international. And then just raise your hand because a lot of people just, they don't want to. Like, it is hard, right? The quick story in France, we had the deal was there was an allowance to live to go over there. So the package wasn't for the family to travel over. So we rented this place and it's all great. And we go into it. And we go into the kitchen. There's nothing in the kitchen except for a sink. There's no stove or dishwasher or anything like that. But there's also no kitchen cupboards. Like in France, when you rent an apartment, there's nothing there. So you have to. So we didn't know we were going to go buy, cupboards before we could even live in this place. But you struggle, and the kids. There were tears at the beginning with the kids. But I also think they would both tell you that they're happy for the experience. It helped them.
Wait, there's no actual furniture? Like you rent the place and you have to bring your own.
It was totally
kitchen.
Yeah. Now, there were like executive kind of apartments that were all fully furnished, but that wasn't the deal that we had. So anyhow, it was we knew there was not going to be a sofa or a bed, but we didn't realize that we were going to be buying kitchen cabinets.
I have watched some videos of Americans moving to Germany and saying basically the same things is the apartments that they rent, you bring your own kitchen. And if you're not aware of that, it is a very rude first you walk in and there's nothing in the kitchen awakening.
Yeah. No, it was wild. But yeah, so I think that's the thing first get yourself in the right place where those opportunities are going to exist. And then there won't be that many people raising their hands, I think, because it's a lot of people don't want to go do that. And that's fine.
I will make again the comment of, I think you need a very supportive family. Obviously, I'm sure there were some discussions and negotiations that you went through before moving. I think you're maybe painting us a very simple picture, but it takes quite a bit of a conversation. And I'll tell you from personal experience. Yeah, I was going through a similar, I guess, ordeal. I was traveling, so my arrangement was a little bit different where I didn't move, but I was going to the same site for close to 2 years, essentially coming back for the weekend and then going there for 2 weeks and then coming back for the weekend. And I can tell you, it's difficult on relationships, right? So I'll leave it at that. But
no, you're exactly right. I was going to get to that. You're right. There's pluses and minuses, right?
I was going to say, before we jump into to some of those, and I feel like that's the other half of the story, I just want to ask Huck, if you could go back and do it again, would you go take the opportunities to geographically relocate either you yourself the first time in Australia or you with the family for some of these different opportunities?
Absolutely, in a heartbeat. And making sure that it works for the family, as Vlad said. Nancy could have said no to that very first one, and we would have never left the U.S. But it was in her spirit, and maybe that's one of the things that connected us, that she was adventurous as well and wanted to go do it. And there were, she did make sacrifices, right? She put her career on hold to go do that. And, you know, she went back to work after we got back from France and resumed her career and is doing gangbusters and doing really interesting work now. But it was a sacrifice for her. Absolutely. I would do it again, given the right circumstances, right? It has to work for everybody who's impacted by the thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But no, I wanted to ask that question because the kind of next topic is being a road warrior, which I know lots of people have more experience with and is generally not perceived for probably 80 to 95% of people in a super positive light. And so before we start talking about some of the perhaps negatives of all of the travel and what can come with that, I just wanted to make sure that we talked about this and finished the thought off in a positive
for sure.
light. But
for sure.
No, so I will go ahead and back off and let you talk about some of kind of the negatives and perhaps some other experiences that you've had, Huck, that are less glorious than showing up to a new country without any sort of kitchen.
Without a kitchen, yeah. The story that Vlad just told there, I have a very similar one. After France, I had a project for a startup solar panel company in the Bay Area. And I went down there for the very first meeting with the customer, and the engineering firm was providing other services. And I went down to go in and sell the MES piece of it. And so I said, you know, well, we'll come down and we'll get some information from you, and then we'll go back and do some work, and then we'll come and deploy things, et cetera. And they said, no, we need you here. Mm-hmm. We're a startup. We can't just give you information and have you run away and go do things. And so I ended up with a team down there of, I think at the biggest point, there were 8 or 10 engineers working in this factory, this startup. And when we first started, there was nothing, it looked like an empty warehouse. The floor was empty, and they built this, it was a thin film. So it was silicon on glass. Solar panels. They started up this factory, and we were there every week for the first year. And it was the same, like you said, Vlad. Monday morning, I would get on a plane for Oakland. Friday afternoon, I'd be on a plane for Portland, and just home enough to disrupt the routines of my family. And so, yeah, that was hard. And the kids were still young at that point, and it wasn't the best time for me to be away that much. And so there is that flip side to it that's not as great. I think today there's not as much, there's still circumstances where you have a customer like that who needs you on the floor. But I think there's so much more we can do remotely today than in the past that maybe the business isn't as bad on families as it used to be. Mm-hmm. I certainly had that as we talked in the last time I was on, I was working for Grantech before this, I started this new company. And in my job there, I was doing a lot of front end work, but I didn't travel very much. Even the people who were doing deployments, that tends to be like the MES crew is going to travel less than the controls group, right? Because you really have to spend more time on the floor making control system work. But even those guys who were deploying vision systems and stuff, they didn't travel a ton. There's probably somebody in the comments disagreeing with me right now, but it seems like it's less than it was 10 years ago.
And I will say, Huck, to that point, again, my comment, looking back at least at my experiences, I think you can always negotiate a little bit better. And I think educating the customer is important, right? Because what you've described also is, I think they simply wanted you to be there, but a lot of times they don't fully understand what you're doing. So I personally was even programming from on-site that things that I could have done remotely, simply because they have the money, they're going to tell you they need you on site, and obviously they will call you into the factory if there's problems. But a lot of times it could have been done remotely, and I think it's the ownership falls at that time on me to have been better in communicating what other arrangements could have been done.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Vlad. And depending on the environment you're working in, if you're running your own business, then you get to call that shot. You get to say, no, Mr. Customer, I can't take this job if you need me there every week because I can't do that. I can't accept those terms. If you're working for a large integration firm as the road warrior, you're not gonna get to make that decision. Somebody's got to go do that thing. And that's a longer term negotiation between you and your employer on keeping that balance.
Yeah, sure. I guess. My comment wasn't like to rock the boat. My comment was more, obviously you can influence.
Vlad setting the boat ablaze.
That is the thing I love about the systems integration business is getting to see all these different production environments and workplaces and cities. And the downside is I have to be away from my family sometimes.
Absolutely. I guess I'd like to make two comments here. First, if you guys haven't been watchers from the very beginning, Huck was actually guest number 10 or episode number 10, which would be guest like 5 or 6 on the show. So if you guys haven't seen Huck's first episode, in fact, Huck's first episode predates my 4,000 line draft that I have going with a bunch of show notes. So I had to go back and check him out on the internet. But you guys go check out episode 10. The show actually looks a lot different now than it did back then. So go check out episode 10 to hear
a bit more about
Huck.
Gray hair.
Huck's background. I'm pretty sure my beard is longer.
Probably. I think so. I was wondering what episode it was, actually. I've been joking with some of my other colleagues who have been on the show more recently that I was on before anybody was watching, but then you invited me back. Hopefully this isn't the end of it.
I'm sure it's not. Huck and I have seen each other a number of times in person. We've talked an awful lot in between episodes. Huck is just one of those people that I don't know how we've gone 150 episodes in between, but I cannot imagine that we go 150 episodes in between again. But
I'm glad you invited me back.
To your point, Huck, I think that it's a really good kind of point of, you would think that with newer technology, there would be opportunity to do a lot more of this remote. I find that it's really customer dependent. As recently as, I don't know, a year or a year and a half ago, I was working with this young kind of startup group, and we're like, hey, the average age is probably like 28. You guys have to know how to use the internet. Like, you have to be able to turn on a Google Meet or a Teams meeting, and we should be able to go have a conversation on the internet. And it was like I had walked into a nursing home, Huck, because like I would show up and wait for a Teams meeting to start. And then they're like, oh, we had this meeting and we never turned it on. And so there are some groups that are more, and it was literally like that for basically the entire engagement. And so there are some people who are structurally better prepared as an organization to go do some of this digitally and natively. And I have found some groups, especially groups that I would think should be able to go ahead and do this, just are never able to get there. I would also say that as a systems integrator, if you guys are a systems integrator, there is both intrinsic and like literal monetary value of sending your people to places, because then they can see that work is being done. And we may or may not get into this later, but the whole kind of proposition of being a systems integrator is we get paid by the hour for the work that we do, almost exclusively. Sometimes there are differing options there, but we get paid by the hour. And so if we're traveling people there, we're getting paid for their travel time. We are getting paid for the work they're doing. We're getting reimbursed for expenses, maybe expenses plus some percentage of that. So when it comes to work as a systems integrator, I find that lots of groups do things on site because there's lots of value of doing those things on site. And if your goal is to do as much remotely and then go on site for hopefully a week or two and deploy, you have to be both very specific and explicit, both in how you do projects, as well as the type of customers that you have, because some large percentage of customer is going to be comfortable with the way that they've done it always and before.
Yeah, it's very true. And yeah, it comes with that territory of the pluses and minuses of that, of this work. And I think that the flip side is, and as you said, a lot of it is perception, right? The customer can see you sitting on the pickle bucket with your laptop on your knees,
yep.
Then they're happy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Never mind that you could be at home doing the same thing with dual monitors and being much more productive and not in the way of the operations people who are trying to still get their work done.
Yep.
That guy's on the pickle bucket again, and I can't get to the machine, you know?
I completely agree with this. And I almost want to like throw the question to Vlad, because as Vlad said, he has done this for some not insignificant number of years of his life. Vlad, do you want to go add some of your painful, hard-fought pickle bucket experience to this?
I've worked at an actual pickling facility, so
there's that. Nice.
But no, look, at the end of the day, it is perception in many ways, right? And I think that it's important to, I want to say, make the customer happy. And like I said, in retrospect for myself, I think part of that is also educating them, because they simply don't understand. It's not because they want you to sit on that bucket and be unproductive. They don't understand that you might be doing better work at home, undisturbed, with a few monitors, with a mouse, with a proper keyboard. And I think it's simply, like, communication is key at the end of the day. But I've, as Dave said, I've been in my fair share of those environments, and I've certainly sat on a bucket and tried to make things work. And some of them required me to be there, right? Because a lot of times on the flip side, I think it's also, how to say it, I don't want to paint the illusion that everything can be done remotely, because I've tried to troubleshoot like palletizers remotely. And I know that takes hours instead of, if I see the problem, it could take minutes, right? And I've been in situations where I'm on a phone call and I'm remoting in on TeamViewer, and then I'm toggling some signals, the palletizer breaks a couple of boxes, and then I ask the technician, hey, what exactly happened? Did it miscount? Was it the wrong pattern? What have you? And like I said, we spent a lot more time than it could have been if I was in person. So I think there's nuances to all of the conversations and examples we're bringing. But yeah, just want to make sure everyone's on the same page.
No, absolutely. And that's another really important point. And in my experience working in the MES space, as I said a little bit ago, the MES team doesn't need to necessarily debug those actuators, right, that are breaking the boxes. Mm-hmm. And so the requirement for them to be on site is generally a lot less. And in fact, you know, sometimes you might have a team of four or five people working on a MES implementation, and only one or two of the people who actually go to site, and the other two are still doing work and downloading new functionality as the on-site team goes to deploy it. And I'll say the flip side is there's two things. One that you, important thing that you said, Vlad, is I can fix it quicker if I can actually see the machine doing what it's doing. But secondly, I will learn 100 times more about how my system should function and what my system should do if I'm there, right? And so there's two parts to that learning. One is if you're new to the business, then you absolutely need to spend time in the production environment to understand the dynamics, right? If I'm building this UI and I've never been on the floor, I don't know what that technician or that operator needs to know, or what, how are they running around, and what do they need to see to make their job be successful. You got to go there to learn those things. So one is like getting educated in the domain. And the second one then is even once you're there, once you have that, you still need to go and understand the user requirements, right? To define what it is this customer needs. And that's not just a one-off. At the beginning, we're going to go spend a day and write everything down and then go away and build a system and come back with the perfectly working thing. That knowledge that you get grows over time, and hopefully you iterate your solution with your customer, and that solution, the thing you're building, benefits from the time you spend on site understanding that environment.
Yeah, and like I said, I guess a closing comment on my side is I think it's, and I don't like the saying you have to pay the price. I think that's overused in our industry, but I think it's more if you've spent the time on the floor, it opens up opportunities to maybe those more senior roles where you can direct more junior engineers to be your sort of like eyes and hands on site. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I think you can transition in something a little bit more remote. But I think it's very difficult to find that immediately. And I think our industry is suffering for that reason a little bit compared to some of the software jobs that are entirely remote for the fact that they don't have physical devices building parts. But in any case, I think it opens up more opportunities if you do invest into the time of working at a systems integrator, going to different sites, seeing things and experiencing them firsthand.
Absolutely. And I would say, if I can add to that, I came to a kind of conclusion early-ish in my career that I did not want to be leaving every Sunday night or Monday morning in order to come back every Friday, half the time after midnight, so early Saturday morning, and enough time to get like 1.5 good sleeps in, wash my clothes, and maybe get a meal at home. Most of the time it's go order something because you're so tired, and then go back out. So I came to that conclusion early on in my career, is I didn't want to spend all of my life on the road. And to that point, I think it is difficult in this industry, because if systems integration work is mostly road warriors and newer people coming in don't know that's what it is. And I feel like lots of times there are job postings that say 20 to 30% that really mean 80 to 100% of travel. It's really difficult to get people to come in and stay in. And I think that's why we see so much burnout and turnover within the first 6 to 12 months, because at that point, it's not worth it. Having said that, I completely agree. There is nothing better and more important than going and getting hands-on experience. Now, it doesn't necessarily need to be hands-on experience that you have to travel every week for. There could be hands-on experience much closer to where you are, and you just have to go to site on a regular basis. But again, I think that is just historically how systems integration has always been, right, wrong, or indifferent. Most people who listen to this kind of know my feeling on that. But right, wrong, or indifferent, that is historically how systems integration has always been. And to that point, that's why I think we see so few large systems integration firms. I think that's why we see so many people that get to a point of, hey, I am a senior or an architect level, let me go hang out my own signal, and maybe I don't have to travel as much, and maybe I can go make more money, and maybe I can go do all of these other things. It almost never happens that way if you guys are in that position thinking about it, because there's lots of other things that need to happen. Like, you have to go find jobs in order for that to happen. But I think that's why we see so much turnover, and that's why we see the continued shift in here. And I'm going to go throw Scott's comment on here about how jobs need to be honest and post for road warriors. And I completely agree. If that is what you're looking for, go find and pay or overpay for those people, because they cost a lot of money, but it's a lot easier to go overpay for that one than to do the alternative of burning a whole bunch of people out at a lower rate. Before we continue and we talk about some more of the changing SI landscape, I do want to point out that I can see there are a bunch of folks on LinkedIn, and only Scott is chatting with us at the moment. So if you guys are watching on LinkedIn, please feel free to go ahead and say hi. I don't bite. Vlad bites a little bit, but Vlad is like far away from everyone, so you guys don't really have to. You don't have to worry about that. But no, please go ahead and say hi. Please go drop some comments. You don't have to comment on the road warrior versus non-road warrior. We don't necessarily want to go get anyone in trouble when it comes to that. But no, having said that, Huck, I want to go back to more of the first question. And Vlad always says the first question is easy. I thought he was going to give you a softball. And then he asked you about the difference between like SIs and consultants and all of these other things. I feel like this should be like an explicit warning of anytime we say this is an easy question, it's not an easy question. Having said that, but no, I guess I'd like to talk a little bit more about SI versus consultant, or maybe the larger, broader question of the changing systems integration landscape, and get your thoughts on that, please.
Yeah, I think that's just it. It's changed a little bit in 40 years. And what I see, and honestly, like probably 10 years ago, like probably about the time that Ignition came on, the thing, and there's not a sales pitch for inductive automation, but I was like, all right, I've been doing this thing for a long time and I've done it and whatever, it's fine, pays the bills. Mm-hmm. But in the last 10-15 years, the work has just gotten much more interesting. And partly Ignition changed the equation on some things back in that day. And that's why I started Old Growth Systems, was I wanted to go build Ignition solutions, and my engineering company was a little bit stodgy and set in its ways and didn't want to move. I did that. I started the company because of that. But since that time, there's so much more opportunities to implement interesting technologies, and you just see that growing all the time. And to answer your question about the changing SI landscape, I think that because the solutions have gotten more complex, there's lots of MES and operations management content that we do today, that the firms have gotten more complex, and being able to deliver a system takes a larger and more diverse skill set. And so I think we've seen that with the larger SI firms for sure. But I also see a trend towards, because the capabilities that we can deliver are more complex today, it takes a lot more money and a lot more effort to do it. And so as you see companies that are succeeding, putting together reusable code, templates, even products, right? Canoa is an example, right? They're a small integrator that is developed MES solutions and now has turned that into a product. And I think they're headed towards focusing on being a product company. So I think that's one of the things that I see has changed, and an important change. And I think it's good for everyone. If an SI can sell a working solution to a customer for less money, and more importantly, in less time, then the customer is more likely to buy it. Mm-hmm. And maybe the road warrior doesn't have to spend as much time on the road, because there's that functionality has already been tested. And we, of course, still have to deal with the box maker that's breaking boxes again. But but the software solution part of it should be becoming more robust out of the box.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you.
Go for it, Vlad.
I was going to ask, so on the same topic of complexity, right? And I think this wasn't very well documented, but I think Tesla had run into a problem where they've added way too many robots at some point in time. And I think the complexity was such that they saw a decrease in productivity. And I believe this was like 5-6 years ago, right? Because obviously everyone wants to automate, but I think there's something to be said about just bloating the complexity to such an extent that requires so many engineers, and there's simply not enough to maintain the facility. Do you think we're headed that way, or do you think we're still in the safe zone?
I might argue that's not new. Yeah. If you go back and read The Goal, which I know we're going to talk about books at the end, but on episode 10, you asked me what book, and
I
brought it up. But in The Goal, remember, they went and bought a robot. And what happened was they needed to show that the robot was paying for itself. So they had the robot making parts that they didn't really need to be made. And so they had all this work in process or excess inventory, I don't remember, because they needed to demonstrate the value of the robot. And so, but more seriously, to answer your question, I do think that you have to be careful about that part of it. And in the systems integration world, a lot of times we're dealing with what manufacturers have decided to do. Mm-hmm. And on a good day, and that was one of the nice things about, if you're thinking about a career, the engineering firm is an interesting place if they have good SI capabilities, because you get to actually work in some greenfield spaces. A lot of SI is in brownfields. There's a factory that's up and running and we're adding some automation or we're adding some OEE or whatever. Those engineering firms are a lot of times are building new factories. And so you actually get to participate in, hey, how should we control this process, and working with process engineers and that sort of thing. But so a lot of times I think we inherit those. We're not going and saying, hey, go put in five more robots generally. At least in my experience, that hasn't been part of the domain of the SI. It's our job to make it work once they've come up with that process or that production method. Have spent a bunch of time in food and beverage where there's still a lot of manual production there. Mm-hmm. There's people on the line. There's automated equipment, but there's people making that work, and there's people working in between. And there's in my mind, there's still probably a good combination of people versus machine. And I don't have as much experience in automotive, and maybe they are going over the top.
No, so my experience is in food and bev also, right? I guess the example that immediately comes to mind is, again, a fairly manual process of you, mm-hmm. as you've described, and then they want to put a case backer at the end, and I'm not going to name the manufacturer of the case backer, right? But it comes with, nowadays, with all bells and whistles, for the right reasons, at least in my opinion, right? Because it can tell if the piston is misfired, you know, if the servo didn't get to the right position. So it has hundreds of different sensors to make sure that everything is working correctly. But the operations team is just, and again, there might be like some training opportunities on that side, but I think they're so far behind that there's like a gap of, if anything goes wrong with that case backer, they immediately have no idea what to do, just because it's so far, mm-hmm. like, a complex compared to what they've been used to before. They have these very basic, like maybe chain case backers or something that's not fairly complex. So they can swap out a photo eye, right? And it's good to go. But now you have these keys. So anyways, that was my kind of train of thought.
I think you raise a really good point. And part of the job is always working with OEMs. And there's a whole spectrum there of OEMs that are great at making equipment but couldn't write a line of ladder logic, to the other extreme that you were just talking about, where in food and bev specifically, I've worked with OEMs that their processing and their PLC code is their IP, and you're not going to, mm-hmm. not only are you not going to touch it, you don't even get to look at it. They have it locked down, and oh, if you want to get data out, or heaven forbid, send a recipe parameter to it, you have to either go through their interface or buy their service. And it's, hang on, that stuff doesn't even talk to our solution. And I don't mean to disparage OEMs, because I think that there's a great opportunity for OEMs to be what I'll call good citizens on the factory floor. I think that's a key to success today for an OEM, is to build your machine to make that box and or fill that jug or whatever it is. Those filling machines are amazing these days. Mm-hmm. And program it or build it so that it's capable of having a sophisticated conversation with the rest of the factory, mm-hmm. whether that's directly with upstream or downstream equipment or with an MES or an operations thing. And I think that's one of the things I would love to see us get better at is, I hate to use the word standard, because lots of bells and whistles go off when people say we should standardize it. But I think we could benefit as an industry by having just the best practices around how do we interface between those layers.
Mm-hmm. I love what you're saying, Huck. I don't know if any of us are still going to be working in this industry if and when we get to that point. I agree that there is some intrinsic value for OEMs to perhaps be good players, good participants, but they have walked towards a very specific path where they've locked down everything for specific IP and otherwise reasons. And I would love the future where we can easily go in and pull that information. I don't know what would have to happen between where we are now and where we are then for that to happen, what is the purpose? Why would they go do that? There needs to be some reason or some value for the OEMs to go do that. And I don't have that. There's not a compelling reason that I can initially come up with that has a financial dollars and cents incentive that I'd imagine they'd need in order for that to make sense.
I think you're painting a much more negative picture of it, Dave.
I'm not trying to, Huck. I'm trying to paint the other half of the picture.
Yeah, no. One of the big food companies that I was recently working for is getting more proactive about specifying what they want when they buy equipment. Yeah. And I think that's where it needs to come from.
I agree.
It's like the larger companies who are going to buy 100 of those fillers need to say, you need to interface to our MES, and we expect a JSON structure that we agree to for information in and out. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's the only way probably to get it to go. So I guess I think my answer to the OEM is there's a carrot there. If you can, I believe in the future, as companies get more sophisticated about the data they want in and out of their machines, they're going to be more interested in buying the machine that offers that. That's my sales pitch to the OEMs that are all listening.
I 100% agree with Huck. I think that, look, the point to be made also is I think that a lot of the smaller factories don't necessarily have the skill set / manpower maybe to negotiate those conversations.
No.
And I think that's where also the integrators or maybe more long-term partners can come in and be the due diligence voice or reason that can help them in the purchasing process. Because I've also seen the same happen where, again, you're simply going to buy an off-the-shelf machine, and then a few years down the road when you do want to integrate it into anything, there's just no options for it, or it's extremely expensive, or it was not discussed at the beginning. So I think spending a bit more R&D dollars, I want to say at the beginning, can save you a lot of hassle down the road.
Absolutely, yeah. For the manufacturing folks out there, get in front of your procurement people. That same company I was talking about that is leading the way, I was working with them in a factory where that didn't happen, and procurement went and bought the things before engineering got to say, hey, you need to make sure we can talk to it. Mm-hmm. And right. So then you're fighting that uphill battle of, hey, Mr. OEM, would you mind adding some logic to your PLC code for us? Mm-hmm. And those conversations are always harder to have after the PO's been signed.
Absolutely. I would say I completely agree that is the correct path forward. Just in my experience, if you're not maybe a Fortune 5000 company, you're not large enough to go bend an OEM to your will to force them to say, you either do this or we go with someone else. And so lots of those other groups are in the process of how do we go build or rebuild some of these parts parallel so we can go have it. So I agree. That is also my hope. Yeah, that is also my hope. Sometimes it's just a little bit easier said than done.
Fair.
Huck, I do want to go transition this because this has once again been an amazing conversation, and we could once again talk for 15 more hours about this. But we had one other area that we want to go touch on, talking about some non-traditional applications. And you're doing some interesting work right now with working systems. Can you tell us a bit about the work that you're doing in its non-traditional sense, please?
Yeah, I'm working on a project for, it's actually a local Portland company that does last mile logistics, and they do it with people powered and electrically assisted delivery trikes. So you have a rider who's pedaling this trike with the help of a battery or electric motor on it with the battery to get up the hill. And they have about 15 of these trikes in their fleet. And I'm helping them put real-time information. We're basically putting an IoT device on the trike and then building the infrastructure to get that data out. And one of my first thoughts in solutioneering this thing was, I'm going to put Ignition up on top to get all this data, but they don't have the budget for that. It's just, this is a very lean operation. And so my constraint has been, how can I build an operational management system that's getting real-time data from the field And honestly, it's different data for sure than what I would get out of a factory, but it's the same thing. It's real-time data is coming in. We need to process it. We're getting information when a rider completes a delivery, and we're using, so there's some chain of custody stuff going on there. And can I put together the components that they need to run their business, but also not build a completely custom solution with a million lines of code that A, they can't afford to pay to get built, and B, they wouldn't be able to maintain. They don't have an engineering team on staff. So what I'm doing actually is I'm using some open source components. Kafka is the main technology that's processing the events as they come in through MQTT. So there's IoT device, which is sending data over the cell to an MQTT broker that then goes into Kafka for the event stream processing. So Kafka is doing all of the heavy lifting of taking that stream of events and doing something meaningful with it. A lot of it's ending up in a Postgres database. So it's several different, so basically it's MQTT, it's Kafka, and Postgres database. And we think maybe we're going to put some stuff in Mongo. And then they're already using Google platform to run the business. And so Google has this dashboard called Looker, which I think is a terrible name, but whatever.
I thought Google discontinued their like IoT, or they discontinued some of the modules, no, on the IoT side?
Yeah, I'm not using any of their. So gotcha. I'm currently deploying on AWS. This is all like proof of concept at this point. We could go to a different platform, but all of my technology stack is completely agnostic to, I could run it in Azure or yep. Vulture or one of the other third parties as well. I actually like, I'm in AWS, they have a thing called Fargate, which will run a container directly. So I don't have to have any underlying architecture for it. Without going into too much, we can go into the nitty gritty of the technology, but the point of it that's interesting to me is that this whole thing is going to probably run in an infrastructure that's going to cost $100 a month, right? And again, it's a small amount of event data that's coming in from those. I'm getting GPS signal every 30 seconds, and then however many deliveries a rider does on a route, and tracking all that. But also, then we're connecting into their timesheet management system and their accounting system to get data in and out from those devices as well. So not a ton of transactions, but what I think is interesting is, and I think that everything I'm doing applies to my manufacturing brain set of this kind of technology, I think starts to make sense for manufacturers. And it doesn't mean that the Ignitions and the Wonderwares go away, but maybe they don't do everything. And so anyway, that's what I'm working on right now.
Again, I definitely agree with your point there. I think manufacturers are still in the early phase of adopting, I want to say. And look, I don't want to say that it's the cloud necessarily. I think this is mostly DevOps / like IT / like software engineering best practices that have been in place for years now. So I think that the right groups are certainly looking into this and understand how it works and are deploying in this way. But I think it's slow in making its way across the industry. And for better or for worse, I think as OT, I want to say predominantly engineers, I think we get too fixated on what's happening on the floor, what's happening inside of a PLC. And I think it takes, because you've had the experience maybe of SCADA and MES systems, you've seen the IT world, and it takes those kind of individuals that can help bring this in. And if you don't have them in an organization, it just becomes a very difficult battle of IT being just the guys who bring switches in or deploy a VM or a server.
Yeah, and I think that has been that divide, the OT-IT divide. We've been talking about that for at least 10 years, right? And I actually think the more interesting way to think about that going forward is not OT versus IT, but on-prem versus off-prem. And what I mean by that is we started out, here's a Modicon 584 controller, and we can control this bottling line. And then we're like, we need to see what it's doing. So we built a UI, right? And then a few years later, we said, we can monitor how many bottles it made, and we can start to create some metrics. And so all of a sudden now we have MES, and we have batch processing. We have all these auxiliary functionalities to the process that we've added on. We've bolted all those on. And in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. there's still this monolithic thing. And it's become, as we've added functionality, it's become more and more expensive to build and deploy and deliver one of those things. I think that where I think we are going and can go and should go is to go back to putting only the things I need on site that are mission critical to running that line at that factory or that operations environment. Only that functionality should be on site. Everything else should be in the cloud. I don't need to calculate my OEE on-prem. I don't need to spin up a server for that. That's not critical. If I lose my connection on a bad day, then I'll still make my product. And also, of course, the cloud connectivity has gotten much more robust. So actually losing that connection is much less likely. So I think that when we start to think about that, then it's like, wait a second, there's all these other technologies up there, like Kafka, and there's all sorts of cool stuff up there that can mm-hmm. produce the same information for you, and maybe in a more elegant, cost-effective way.
There are just so many ways to go with that, Huck. Yeah, there are so many ways to go with that. I think it's an interesting structure. Scott in the chat is saying IT is evil and stupid. Thank you for that, Scott. I actually got a good laugh out of that. I got a good laugh out of it when I saw that come through. I think it's interesting. I think that there are certainly one. I love the deployment that you're doing, and I love as you were talking me through initially when you started doing it of, hey, I'd like to go build this using kind of the normal tools that we've used in industrial for a long time, but also, hey, these guys don't have the budget to go be able to spend $100,000 on software and then add hardware on top of it because their budget is $100 a month. So it's a very different application. I think it's really interesting. I guess first and foremost, thank you for sharing that with us. I think I want to go highlight some more of those as we are continuing down this manufacturing hub in general. Probably not today because Huck has already regaled us time and time again. But no, that is awesome. I feel like that story, what you're doing and your thoughts lead me into kind of the next question that I ask all of our guests. I want you to predict the future, Huck. So what do you think either the future of software or the future of systems integration looks like?
I guess I already answered my first part of my answer is what I was just talking about is I think that we will do more things off-prem and in the space. And I also think that we will do, and maybe this is me being hopeful again, mm-hmm. definitely one of my flaws is optimism, but I think that we're headed towards a more collaborative industry. I see that happening more, and I see people sharing their solutions, and I'm really hopeful for that because reinventing the wheel's kind of dumb. And it's one of the things that I think has held us back for a big part of my career is there's... If it wasn't built here, then it wasn't any good. And everything was a reinventing of the wheel or a templatizing the thing so we can be more efficient with it. But we're not going to share that. And I see that changing. And I hope that trend continues. And I want to be a part of that, of collaborating in the field on what are the best practices and how do we architect and engineer and implement our unified namespace, right? We almost got all the way through the pod without saying unified namespace, but there it is. But that is an idea. That it's nothing more than an idea. And what it needs is best practices around it. It's a really good idea too, by the way, mm-hmm. whoever came up with it. I don't know who it was. But actually, what are the best practices for implementing that thing? And how do we get our OEMs to be a part of it? Mm-hmm. That's where I see us having the opportunity to be more collaborative in the industry.
Absolutely.
Slight comment, Dave, if I may. I think We probably should have extended this podcast like 3 hours, because now I'm curious about architectures, and I even had some questions on the implementation of your Kafka queues. But anyways, that's maybe a story for another
day. We should talk about that, Vlad. We can do that offline.
All right, perfect.
Absolutely. Huck absolutely could. This absolutely could have been a 3-hour conversation. But for our listeners at home who are expecting a more kind of shorter conversation as we normally have Huck, I love
the 30 on the East Coast, right?
Almost, yeah. What was I going to say? But no, I love the comment about the more collaboration and the sharing of kind of those concepts and ideas. I love that. Maybe, and I feel like we touched upon some career advice of, hey, if you're looking to go travel internationally, go look at this. But do you have maybe some other career advice that is worth saying?
I do. The first one is stay curious. I think that's the key to success in this business is you have to be curious. You have to want to know, why does this factory run the way it does? And what are the people trying to accomplish that are on the floor? And I think that's a hugely important piece of what we do. And the second one is go to the Gemba, which I always thought was, I actually looked it up when I wrote it down earlier today. I always thought it meant go to the source of the problem, but it actually means go to the, I think, the literal translation is the actual place. So go to the actual place, go to the place where the thing is getting done. And from Vlad's perspective, I have to do that every day anyway. What are you telling me? But as some of us do all of our work remotely behind with our bunny slippers on, you really need to get out there and understand the factory environment. So that's a second one. And then the last one is be intentional about that work-life balance. Know that you have to negotiate that with for yourself, for your family, and with your employer, right? Whether you're a system integrator or you're working in the directly in the manufacturing environment. And by the way, those guys don't have to do that road warrior thing that we do, but they do get the calls at 3 a.m. when the line's not doing what it's supposed to do. So it's not totally rosy on that side of the fence either.
Absolutely. No, I think all of those are good. I've always took the phrase go to the Gemba is to go to the floor and or understand the process. But I think all of those are very similar. Next talk, we'd like to ask for a book and or some content recommendation, please.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll start with content. Udemy. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Udemy. At Grand Tech, they had a corporate account. Everyone at Grand Tech had access to Udemy. And it's, if you don't know what it is, it's an online learning environment. You can type in PLC. You'll find some courses on PLCs in there. It won't be as good as Vlad's, but they're there. But and you can also learn how to bake a cake or whatever you want to do. But I've been using it extensively to try to understand Kafka and AWS and containers and all that stuff. You can buy an annual pass for, I think it's $200, it's $20 a month or something. And it goes well beyond, you can ask ChatGPT to do a thing for you, or you can Google what you want. There's lessons that build on one another that teach you the foundations of things. And I just think it's a really great way to stay current with or learn a new thing. So that's a content thing. Slightly off topic of technology specific, but Pitchfork Economics is this really cool podcast that I guess the way I would tie it into what we do is we work in capital intensive environments, a lot of times for big companies. And that podcast spends a lot of time talking about the power and the finance and I'll say there's some liberal content in there about redirecting the wealth balance in the United States. But anyway, there's a lot of really useful knowledge coming out of that podcast. So that's interesting. And then I'll go quick. There's actually three books. I looked at my books and there wasn't anything super compelling, but we talked about the goal. Mm-hmm. Goldratt actually wrote a series of books. And the last one he wrote was called The Haystack Syndrome. And it's about a computer system that runs a factory. And it was written in 1990. So don't pick this up if you want to design a computer system. In fact, he started a business to build this thing that he wrote about in the book, and it failed.
Yeah.
But what I think is still relevant about the book is it talks about like the mindset of how do you think about manufacturing and get convert dated information. A lot of it's about that. It's like, how do you actually get useful information out of that PLC full of data? So that's one.
What was the idea? Sorry, Huck. The idea was to build a business to extract data or build systems?
So he was building basically an operational management system that, so if you read the goal, theory of constraints. So his idea was to build a software system that supported a manufacturing operation that was running under the philosophies and principles of theory of constraints. And so that it's an interesting read. It's light. It's like the goal in that he writes it in the Socratic method. You can get through it. It's entertaining. And then David Nichols from Loop. I don't know. Have you had him on?
He's been on, I think, three times. Yes.
I need to go back and listen. So maybe he already told you this when he was on, but he recently recommended this on his channel. It's also a really old book, and I picked it up used. It's called The SMED System, which is Single Minute Exchange of Dies. It's all about, on the surface, it's about changeovers. When you're doing a setup to change from one product to another, but it's really about analyzing when is your equipment actually productive versus when it's not, and why. And so again, it's just, I think it was written in 1985 or something, but it's another place where if you want to like think about what's really going on inside of a factory to help you build a better system, that's an example of that. And then the last one is totally not work related. Cloud Cuckoo Land is this fantastic science fiction book that I read recently, and it's big, you can see, but it's just a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed reading that. There you go.
No, awesome, Huck. Thank you so much for all of those recommendations. I will make one point to the Goldratt Institute and the theory of constraints. Lots of really good ideas. A shockingly large number of failed initiatives came out of some of those ideas. So I think it's interesting. It puts a bit of a humanity perspective on it, at least when I think about that and how successful they were when Eli was still alive. But Huck, this has been awesome. Last question for you is, how can our listeners help you? Who should reach out? Who are you looking to talk to?
I told a little bit about my business. It's small, and I'm looking to engage in interesting projects where I can make a difference. I'm really focused on small to mid-sized manufacturing companies that want to improve their operations by doing this work. And so that's my sales pitch. Mm-hmm. But I think also, if you're in the SI business, and I'm happy to talk about direction or any of that stuff, if any of it's relevant. I want to see the small SIs. I just talked to a company on the West Coast that's getting ready to hire their second employee. So it's going to be a 3-man shop. Wow. And they have big ideas about building a business. And I think they have some really good plans on how to do that, how to build a company that's good for the people as well as building good solutions for their customers. And I think that's the challenging balance.
Absolutely. Huck, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming back on. Again, we will get you on sooner than episode 300. Everyone, thank you for coming to hang out with us. This has been awesome. If this was your first Manufacturing Hub, come check us back out next week. Almost any next week that you're talking about, we will be here Wednesday at about 4:00 East Coast time. If you guys have made it this far, make sure that you're connected with Huck and Vlad and myself. Make sure you're following Manufacturing Hub. If you're watching on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to podcast form or honestly anywhere else, go ahead and hit that and follow and rate us the places you can rate us, and go do all of those things because it helps the metrics. Until next week, we'll see everyone soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.